You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. We are here with Rick Rule, and he's currently enjoying his faux retirement, hopefully. And we're going to be talking about recent metals prices, the issue of permitting, and the National Defense Authorization Act. And of course, I want to start out, though, off topic, totally, Rick, talk about the most favorite topic of the media. Now that a certain president is no longer in office, they had to find somebody else, and it's Elon Musk, and it's Twitter, and it's EVs, it's Tesla, it's tunnels, boring tunnels, and Neuralinks, and you name it. This guy is involved in everything, satellites, internet service. What is your take on Elon Musk? What can we learn from what he is doing and what he's accomplished?
Well, that's a huge question. I at once vilify him for the billions of dollars in subsidies that he has received. I guess you can't blame him for taking money on offer when it's on offer. But I sort of resent his depredations on the taxpayer. On the other hand, I admire his public utterances more and more and more. I guess very much like anybody would admire a lightning rod, in the sense that he's standing up to take heat that might otherwise find its way to me. In that sense, I'm attracted to him. I'm particularly interested on the Twitter issue and freedom of speech. The freedom of speech pundits, it would seem, prefer freedom of speech that agrees with them, as opposed to true freedom of speech. When they talk about the preponderance of misstatement of facts on the right, which is true, they ignore their own misstatements of fact, like the federal deficit is sustainable. And so I'm curious about that. I also believe that these private platforms are just that. Private platforms. And to the extent that somebody who owns a private platform, as an example, decided to ban me from it, well, it would piss me off. I think that's absolute right. That's their absolute right. I think, too, that a proliferation of private platforms owned by people with differing points of view is the best guarantee of freedom of speech overall that we might enjoy. From a commercial point of view, I have no idea how he saw that much value in Twitter. Although if you look at his net worth, he's been right at least as often as he's been wrong. My suspicion is that Mr. Musk saw in social media the same disaggregation of market share that Murdoch saw in Fox, which is to say, among the broadcast media, the progressives or the center left controlled 5 or 6 channels and competed for 50 or 55% of the market share among 5 or 6 claimants. And Murdoch was able, by pandering to the right, to get complete control of 40% market share, which is to say the rightist market share. And my suspicion is that Mr. Musk looks at the differentiation or disaggregation of market share in social media in the very same fashion. He sees that the major social media platforms are all primarily progressive in orientation, and probably sees that there is a very large underserved market. It's true, too, that Mr. Musk's proclivity with social media has meant that the advertising expenditures that Tesla has had to spend over the last 10 years have been effectively nil, relative to his less nimble competitors, the Toyotas, the GMs, and the Fords of the world. And it could be that Mr. Musk understands the latent value in social media and has ways to monetize the community around Twitter that the incumbent management didn't have. Mr. Musk's flirtation with crypto, as an example, and his ability to have a Twitter coin or a Musk coin, and to promote that coin on a platform as broad as Twitter, particularly as broad as Twitter, after it captures the non-center left and non-progressive market share on a global basis. All very, very, very interesting topics. I need to say you got me way, way, way outside of any expertise I might have, but I've been thinking about all of these issues at some length, probably to no benefit.
Hey, same here. And yeah, it does open up possibilities. The thing I was looking at is, so all, pretty much all social media, and that includes Google, YouTube, all way, way progressive, way to the left, to the point where they're censoring, banning everybody. And once he's got Twitter with 200 plus million daily visitors, it's real simple to set up Twitter Tube, Twitter Search,
right,
Twitter PayPal, because they've been deplatforming, and he can basically just expand it to cover every aspect of social media off of one platform. That's what I'm thinking he's going to do. But one thing we know with Elon Musk, you never know what he's going to do. He's completely unpredictable. I agree with you about the subsidies that he's been the beneficiary of, but we all know that just because you get subsidies doesn't mean you're going to be successful. All we have to do is look at Solyndra and Fisker and Nikolai and all these other companies that have been the beneficiaries of government largesse, and that really hasn't done them any good.
You make a very good point. He at least is a successful criminal. and I guess we should rejoice at that. I suspect that someday I'll be a beneficiary of the subsidy, because at some point in time in the future, I'm likely to buy an electric car. And given the reviews that I've received from my friends who own Tesla, it will likely be a Tesla. I'm hoping too to be a direct or indirect beneficiary of Mr. Musk's various space endeavors, likely indirectly as a communications consumer, but maybe more directly, which I would look forward to. The idea that he might someday be successful in a metropolitan area like Los Angeles or New York City in relieving traffic congestion through the Boring Company fills me with a lot of hope. I'm embarrassed, coming out of the mining industry, that he has made technological advances in subterranean excavation in 10 years that eluded our industry in 100 years. And I'm delighted that somebody had done it. I wish it was us. But the fact is that somebody had to do it, and he was the guy, which is great. He's also now said fairly publicly that the mining industry is the most open to disruption of any industry he's ever seen, which I guess is another way of saying that we are the most glacial and resistant to change industry that he knows. And since we seem to be unable to convert a waste element called lithium into physical lithium for batteries, he's decided that probably he has to begin to mine lithium. And I have to say, I welcome him to the fray. I think the industry will be better for it.
Yeah, hey, that's interesting. You know, I didn't really liken the whole Boring Company thing to actually what happens with mining. But really, these boring machines, the next one, Prufrock 3, he says it's going to do like 7 miles a day of tunneling. Can you imagine this? It takes these mining companies years and years and billions of dollars to do what he's doing in a day.
Well, like any promoter, he's guilty of gross exaggeration. Like any mining promoter, by the way. Let's assume he was off by a factor of 10. It still beats what the industry does.
I'm going to Las Vegas this week for a conference, and I'm hoping that the new tunnel to Resorts World is opened, which will take you right to the convention center, and then I can go take the tunnel under the convention center in these Tesla vehicles, because it just sounds pretty cool that you could do this quickly. You know, it took like the Lincoln or the Holland Tunnel, which is, I think, the first major tunnel in the United States. It took them like 5 years to do this. And this guy comes along and maybe he could get it done in 6 months, because that's only a mile and an eighth long.
And remember the big dig in Boston. I forget how many years it took to sort out who would get the bribes. I mean, the fiscal arrangements would be around the big dig.
15, 20 years they're talking about, and they're still working on it.
By that point in time, you know, Musk likely would have had vehicles running.
He probably would have gone around the city of Boston five times
right.
the amount that it took them to actually do it. So, talking about mining, recently, and we'll get to metals prices later, but recently the Biden administration invoked the National Defense Authorization Act so that we can get all these vital metals that we so desperately need, like lithium, like rare earth. I didn't see copper in it. I think nickel was part of it. And then there's an article in Zero Hedge that says basically, hey, you could invoke that act all you like, but it's the permitting, stupid. Because the whole permitting schema, and they mentioned, Rick, one thing they mentioned, at one time the United States had 1,000 active mines, mining various minerals, metals, etc. Now we're down to 300, and they just can't seem to figure out how to make it work.
I think they've figured out how to make it work for them. There is, I think, a strong sort of narrative among the chattering classes and among, if you will, the ruling classes, the big thinkers, around what I guess you'd call the World Economic Forum narrative. There's a strong bias against material progress. Now, is it cynical? Of course, when they take 400 or 500 private jets to Davos to tell you and I to drive less, you know, their actual thinking is fairly exposed. I think that Mr. Biden saw that the population is concerned about the security of their material wealth. And I think that Mr. Biden addressed that publicly with no intention of following through privately. As you point out, if you wanted to increase the production of mineral resources in the United States, the easiest thing that the government could do is get out of the way. From an environmental perspective, as an example, we could adopt the Chilean methodology, which is that when you submit an environmental impact statement, it becomes a contract between you and the government. It can be 40 or 50 pages long, saying there will be no export of deleterious materials from the mine site. If you violate it, it's a criminal offense. it would be fairly easy in the United States if mining executives understood that if they violated the terms of an environmental impact statement, that they would go to the slammer. That would probably achieve 99% reform in the beginning. But what you're seeing really is a political statement that the administration has no intention of following through on. At the same time that Mr. Biden is suggesting to the Saudis that they increase the production of oil, Mr. Biden refuses to assist in the permitting of a pipeline from Canada, which already has 2 million barrels a day of surplus production. If you wanted to produce more oil, theoretically, the Canadians are at least as friendly suppliers as the Saudis are. And at the same time, you reduce the availability of federal land for drilling in the United States, which is, after all, the world's largest oil producer, by 90%. At the same time that you describe U.S. oil and gas executives as greedy and obstructive. In other words, you prohibit them from drilling wells, and then you avail against them publicly for not drilling wells. This is fairly easy to explain. This is all politics. This is all narrative. This is all political public relations. Or, in more stark fashion, this is all a cynical ball of lies.
So true. And yeah, we're out there trying to get the resources that we need, that the world needs, and then we're doing everything in our power to stop it. And then when we can't stop it, then we'll just go revoke permits, right? We'll just revoke them. And unlawful, you know, normally you never see a permit once it's issued by an agency of the U.S. government revoked unless there was fraud in the inducement. If there is material fraud in your application, yes. But just to put the brakes on a project, to slow it down, to stop it, you ever see anything like this, Rick?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
I've not, but to be honest with you, I haven't looked very hard. I notice now, as an example, that there are pressures from the big thinkers, including from the SEC, to disclose the potential impacts of global warming and climate change in financial results. I'm going to encourage the Sprott board, the only public board where I'm a director, to address that specifically and say, I don't know, we don't know, you don't know, and nobody knows. This is the most full and fair disclosure that someone could possibly have. It's not what the big thinkers have in mind, but if you look at the big thinkers' track record of success in matters like this, it's virtually unblemished by success. So to the extent, as an example, that Al Gore knows what's going to happen in the climate, you need to examine his track record over the last 40 or 50 years. He was part of the old Club of Rome guys who suggested that by the year 2000 that there would be mass starvation in the world, that the oil price would be $200 a barrel, a real Malthusian type. It wasn't that he was wrong, Kerry. It was that he was massively, laughably wrong. I don't know what's going to happen in 30 years or 40 years or 50 years. And so the easiest way that I can discuss the potential impact, economic impact of climate change in extractive industries is simply to acknowledge the regulation and tell the truth, which is to say, I don't know.
Yeah. So ignorance of the law is no defense, pleading ignorance. I want to see how far that's going to get you, but I love the concept. It's like, hey, if you tell me how to figure it out, you guys are so smart. What program should I use?
Yes. And explain to me why I should believe you. Just like, you know, as long as this is a legal document and I am supposed to be relying on the best available evidence, try and establish for me what that best available evidence might be. I would argue, Kerry, that there is none. I'm not trying to say, by the way, that these climate change guys are wrong. I'm only trying to say that their willingness to state that they're right with regards to their future is in glaring contradiction to their track record.
Yeah, very true. I mean, yeah, like, well, maybe they're going to make it come true in terms of $200 a barrel oil and whatever that leads to as a result, the fertilizer shortages, everything else. I mean, hey, more and more commodities, prices going parabolic here. And
yeah, I must say, in terms of my own balance sheet, my own income statement, Mr. Biden is a friendly. If he makes the establishment of more supply impossible, the ownership of the existing means of production, at least with regards to my US-based oil and gas producing assets, I should be thanking him, I suspect.
Yeah, well, you said quite a while ago that energy was going to go up substantially in price. And you look at nat gas, it over $8 per million
BTU.
Yeah. Million BTUs. I mean, I guess you don't have to be a genius to figure this one out, right?
I remember thinking that I would have died and gone to heaven if I saw $5. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's happening in Europe, it's far worse.
Right. I mean, right.
$30 a million BTUs.
Well, Europe is something that American voters need to look at, the ones that are narrative obsessed. You know, the Germans were the richest. And so the Germans were able to carry stupidity to its greatest extent. The idea that you would run a large industrial economy on solar power in Northern Europe, where the sun doesn't shine, Should I be polite and say it's questionable? The Europeans, or the Germans in particular, have seen the result of that, not merely because of geopolitics, but also because they shut down 80% of their nuclear fleet. They've had to increase their consumption of coal spectacularly, thus blowing any chance they ever had of meeting their Kyoto Protocol pledges. An interesting circumstance that we're in, Kerry.
Yeah. Well, there's always been a war on stupidity. And fortunately, during important times of history, the opponents of stupidity, mass stupidity, have prevailed, like right. The Renaissance. And like
Elon Musk.
Yeah. But now I think I'm beginning to think we're like drastically outnumbered and overmatched. And I'm just wondering how this is all going to wind up.
Kerry, I think we're going to win. I think it's going to be a pretty good fight. But I continue to believe that humankind is tenacious enough, and when it operates well, self-serving enough and creative enough, that our individual productivity will continue to finance our collective stupidity. I hope that's true. And I take great solace, and this is going to make me sound politically correct, which is, you know, I'm not. But I take great solace from the inclusion that we've seen over the last 40 years. The willingness of humankind, as an example, to admit the IQ of half of humankind, which is to say women, to things like technology and business, the democratization of technology and communications, so that you're seeing real leaps, as an example, in fintech technology in Africa. You know, in previous interviews, Kerry, I said that the United States was still so creative that five or six kids could take over a garage in Sunnyvale and out would pop Google. So a couple interesting things in the future. Some of those kids are going to be named Mary or even Karen. And
not Karen, please.
who cares where progress comes from? They don't have to like me. And increasingly, that garage may be in Lagos or Jakarta. And so in that sense, I'm fairly optimistic about the future. The politicization of the future and the preponderance of narrative over arithmetic bothers me. But, you know, Kerry, it's bothered me since the 1970s. And my gut feeling is that although there will be tremendous challenges along the way, that we'll bumble through the next 50 years the same way we bumbled through the last 50 years.
Yeah. Well, you just made me reminisce about Winston Churchill saying, if you're 18 and not a liberal, you have no heart. If you're 40 and you're not a conservative, you have no mind. And maybe because the infantilization of society, where people are growing up, at least in the U.S. and in Western countries, maturity comes much later. Maybe it's going to be 50 where that realization comes about instead of 40.
Well, by that characterization, Kerry, I'm going to need some transplants. I'm not and never have been a liberal. And I'm not and never have been a conservative. I'm a libertarian, which I guess people would suggest if they're Churchillian types, but I'm an empty skin, but be it as it may.
Well, it just reminds me that Will Rogers saying, I'm not a member of any organized party, I'm a Democrat. Well, I think what it applies to now is, if you're not a member of any organized party, you're a libertarian, because we just can't seem to get this to work here, to explain the benefits of just letting the markets work and stepping aside.
You know, Kerry, a week ago, I was on a worldwide web-hosted call with about 150 young entrepreneurs assembled by Students for Liberty. And I have to say that if you come off a conference call talking to young libertarians, first of all, the existence of Students for Liberty, a 160,000 person organization worldwide of young people. Kerry, when I was their age, I couldn't spell libertarian. Now, granted, 160,000 isn't a lot of people against the population of the earth, but our market share is increasing, at least.
Hey, one man with courage is a majority, Rick, right?
Right.
So true. So, I could talk to you about metals prices, commodities prices, but they're all heading higher in any event. And I think this was a better discussion of prioritization, that we need to really get our priorities straight. And that means getting the politics out of the debate. And maybe that's too much to hope for, but I guess we're both at heart optimists and believe that the strides we've made in the past 50 years, all the people, billions of people not living in poverty, no longer malnourished, have a roof over their heads, that there is hope for this.
Well, that's, you know, certainly what you say is both true and good. In extractive industries, I spent a lot of my time in frontier and emerging markets. And you look at a society like Malawi, where the biggest public health challenge 35 years ago was starvation. Now it's obesity. I'm not arguing in favor of obesity, but at least it's a matter of choice. And I'm amazed by the increase in living standards enjoyed by the poorest of the poor, and I hope it continues.
Absolutely.
And politics aside, I think it can.
I agree. And hey, at least if you're obese and the food supply gets cut off, you can live off your fat. If you're malnourished and the food supply is cut off, you're in a lot more trouble.
That's right.
So definitely obesity is preferable to malnourishment any day of the week, although neither is a good health condition to be in. All right. So it's ruralinvestmentmedia.com. That's where we find your latest works, right?
Absolutely. Any of your listeners who care about my natural resource ideas as opposed to my wonky politics can go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, enter their natural resource stocks. I will personally rank them 1 to 10. I'll comment on those issues where I think my comments might have value, and I look forward to the conversation.
All right. And as a reminder, July 26th to July 29th, it is the Rural Symposium, Natural Resource Investing in my neighbor Boca Raton, Florida. So I will definitely be there. And we will put a link in the show notes of this interview so you can sign up. If any of you can't afford to go there, like I said, I started a podcast foundation for people to help them be able to get out and participate in these events. Just send me an email, kl@carrylutz.com, and just show need, and we'll take care of you for it. All right.
Thank you, Carrie. As always, I believe that our Natural Resource Investment Symposium is the finest of its kind in the world. And as always, with all of our educational products, there's a 100% money-back guarantee. If you come to the symposium and don't believe that you got your money's worth, send me an email and I'll refund that money.
Unless I paid for the ticket, in which case I'll take the refund. We got to be specific, hey, man. We're living in a world of free money here, Rick. Hey, always appreciate you coming on. And we'll talk to you again soon, and we'll see you in Boca.
My pleasure, Carrie. Look forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.